It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The year brought some significant updates at some Wisconsin's major business development projects. In Mount Pleasant, Microsoft paused construction on portions of its new data center campus as they reevaluate future phases of the project. And around the same time, a subsidiary of Taiwan's Foxconn acquired 20 more acres of land in the area, but hasn't said what it plans to do. In Green Bay, local leaders are preparing to host the upcoming NFL draft and oversee the completion of multiple housing developments in the area. So we're catching up on the latest big news around the state in the new year, first with Joe Schultz, WPR reporter covering statewide business, labor, and economic issues. Joe, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What can you tell us about Microsoft's construction pause here on this multi-billion dollar data center campus?
So Microsoft is kind of developing their like three different sites in Mount Pleasant. They've kind of paused work at two of those sites. The company says that it's pausing early construction on what it calls the second phase of its development. It says that it's still on track with the first phase of the data center project, and it's still on pace to spend $3.3 billion by the end of 2026. The company says that they kind of paused some of the like second phase and future phase work as they kind of reevaluate just kind of like how changes in technology could kind of shape, you know, some of their design aspects. The Village of Mount Pleasant says that the pause was done to allow Microsoft to incorporate new data center designs. And the Village still anticipates the first phase of Microsoft's project is going to get completed this year. And it doesn't appear that officials are, you know, concerned that this could lead to a change in like the scope of the project. Officials still seem pretty confident is kind of my understanding that the project's still going to happen.
Well, it's interesting because Microsoft announced Friday that it plans to invest about $80 billion in fiscal 2025, this fiscal year, on developing these data centers to train and deploy AI. And of course, you know, AI requires enormous computing power. And so it makes me wonder, how should we read this pause or pullback in Mount Pleasant?
I mean, Microsoft says that it's still committed to the Mount Pleasant development. And obviously, you know, all these tech companies keep talking up AI and just kind of like are a little infatuated with AI. Like every social media you kind of go on, there's some new AI function that the tech companies want you to use. I don't know how to read it beyond just kind of like what the company is saying at this point, that the Mount Pleasant project is, you know, still a priority for them.
And first phase completion, do you have any type of timeline here?
The Village just says that they're expecting it to finish at this year still.
Okay.
Microsoft didn't get too into the timelines. It's not entirely clear just kind of like how long the pause on those, you know, on that phase two could last. You know, and Microsoft also acknowledged that like if their plans change and they have to redesign things, they may still have to go back to the state and to like the local government to get different permit approvals. They might have to like revise their permits. So the pause and some of like the reevaluation stuff could add timelines on those like future phases of the project.
Okay, now we're going to turn to other question marks here with a subsidiary of Foxconn acquiring about 20 acres of land from the Village of Mount Pleasant recently. What can you tell us about this transaction?
So it's kind of my understanding that this was kind of baked into Foxconn's development agreement with the Village of Mount Pleasant. Foxconn didn't, you know, purchase those 20 acres. Those 20 acres were kind of transferred in ownership from the Village to Foxconn. And it's kind of my understanding that, I almost called Foxconn Microsoft. It's kind of my understanding that Foxconn has been paying special assessment payments on the land that they already owned in Mount Pleasant, and that's kind of the way the city's kind of getting paid for this transaction. It was just kind of a transfer and not like a sale.
So where do we stand? Because Foxconn has, of course, backed out of its major development plan in the area, still has this significant footprint in Mount Pleasant. What does that relationship currently look like with the village?
You know, it's not entirely clear. Just kind of like the terms that the village and Foxconn are on. You know, obviously Foxconn's big LCD factory never kind of happened. They say that they produce data servers in Mount Pleasant and that they employ more than 1,000 people. And, you know, the village earlier this year, Foxconn got, you know, another round of state subsidies. And at that time, the village said that, like, they value Foxconn. And the village kind of viewed the Foxconn project late last year as it kind of set the groundwork for some of this development,
mm-hmm.
like Microsoft and, you know, Foxconn, as of last year, was the largest taxpayer in the village of Mount Pleasant at the local level for those property taxes.
Mm.
And the village does anticipate Microsoft will move into that role as the top taxpayer in the village.
Well, Joe, thanks for the update. Thanks for keeping an eye on these projects.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Joe Schultz, business reporter for WPR. Now we turn our attention to the Green Bay area, where coal piles, housing initiatives, they're on the forefront. Of course, the hosting of the NFL draft around the corner. And Jeff Bollier is covering it all, business reporter for the Green Bay Press Gazette. Jeff, welcome back.
Oh, thank you for having me back.
So when you look ahead to business projects on the horizon this year, what is standing out as the most significant for Green Bay?
So it's got to be my number one pick. Sorry for the pun. Would be the NFL draft coming to town.
Yep.
You know, it is going to be a huge event. You know, the expectations are that you know, as many as 240,000 people could experience the event over 3 days.
What did you say that the grounds will be like a small city within Green Bay and Ashwaubenon?
Yeah, they're laying out an area that stretches, you know, as much as, you know, by my rough calculations, you know, it's a mile long area that includes back of the house areas, the draft theater, as they call it, and then areas for fans and visitors to engage that, you know, I mean, pretty much stretches from the Titletown district west of Lambeau Field all the way to the Resch Center, which is well east of Lambeau Field. So there's going to be a lot of area there just where, you know, just to welcome the visitors and all of the activities, the events, the media, you know, all of the teams and their fans. So it's going to be pretty wild to see take shape.
What do you see is Green Bay grappling with most as it puts on this event that comes and goes in a few days and the challenges of those logistics and housing and all the things that come with it?
Yeah, we're, you know, the community up here is sort of trying to prepare as best as it can for this to be ready for setup and takedown, whatnot. But, you know, businesses are sort of trying to figure out where they fit in, from restaurants and bars to hotels. You know, one of the big questions is where everybody is going to stay, considering that, you know, the NFL and its partners have booked a lot of the hotel rooms here in the Green Bay area. So we're looking at short-term rentals. There is interest in hotels, you know, 30, 60 minutes away from here easily. So there's a lot of questions about it as it all comes together, but we're just trying to stay on top of it and keep the community informed.
Well, speaking of housing, I tried to start making a list of all the new housing developments and housing initiatives going up, and then I stopped my list. I'm like, I can't keep track of all this. This is long. What's going on?
You know, starting in 2020, you know, the city of Green Bay or the Green Bay area kind of recognized that it needed thousands more apartments and owner occupied homes to keep up with the demand that and population growth that they see coming through 2040. There's been, as across most of the state, there's been some ups and downs with financing and supply chain and costs, but this year really looks like it's going to be a very high, that housing development's going to get into a high gear. And I did a little counting also, and I got above 850 units that either will start construction this year or will come online this year and be available for people to rent. And that is huge. That will be of huge help with some of the issues again statewide with rising rents and the increasing cost for housing.
Of course, also those construction jobs, a local boom to the economy as well, I'd imagine.
Oh, yes.
I want to look here just for a moment on these coal piles, because as you see all of this waterfront development going up and the
Yeah.
market project, I wonder if that is putting more pressure to get a resolution on moving these coal piles from the waterfront.
Yeah, there is it is long been talked about in Green Bay and the area, for decades about how, as the community has sort of evolved from, a primarily heavily industrial riverfront into more of a mix of commercial, residential, and industrial, coal storage, kind of stands out where it is or sticks out as something where there's an opportunity to redevelop, maybe address some of the housing needs, add some additional, new port or riverfront uses, and also find a new home for a local business, Sea Rice Coal or Sea Rice Company that has been in operation here for 125 years.
Jeff, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to do it.
Jeff Beliar, business reporter at Green Bay Press Gazette, sharing some of those big upcoming business projects in the area. Earlier, we heard from WPR reporter Joe Schultz with updates from Mount Pleasant. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's investigation into accidental shootings in our state and what's being done to prevent them.
So I think that there is a real feeling that this is something that is solvable, and it's really an education piece. Would education be the thing that would help?
How Wisconsin handles accidental shootings, that's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're taking a look at a new first-of-its-kind report from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about unintentional child shootings in Wisconsin. Unintentional shootings are rare, but many of the victims are children. A 1991 Wisconsin law made accidental child shootings that cause injury or death a misdemeanor, although caregivers do not always face charges. That has not been the case in Milwaukee County, where caregivers of children who are hurt or killed in accidental shootings almost always face felony charges. That's according to a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigation led by journalist John Dietrich. Lee Rayburn spoke with Dietrich earlier this week about the numbers and the stories behind them.
In your latest reporting in the Behind the Gun series, investigating firearm deaths in Wisconsin, you look into the accidental child shootings, and you find them to be rare, tragic, and yet, quote, highly preventable. Explain this for us.
So I think that people get the impression that accidental shootings, or as the CDC classifies them, unintended shootings, happen more often than they do. They actually are 1% of overall gun deaths. I think that's surprising to people because there's a lot of publicity and, understandably so around these cases, especially when children get a hold of unsecured firearms. So they are incredibly tragic. And when I say highly preventable, unlike a lot of other, well, really all other gun deaths, There's not an intentionality. So in that way, the prevention strategies really come down to access to the firearms. And that's where they become, they fall into the category of the most preventable of firearms deaths.
1%. How often do these shootings end up in death?
Well, so we have more non-fatal shootings for sure. And that's true in every category. But when we look at children dying in this type of scenario in Wisconsin, it ranges in each year from one or two to the largest year is seven in 2022 that we found in the analysis that we did. So those are small numbers. But when I say small, I don't want to say like unimportant, certainly.
Right.
And because of the preventative nature, really important to emphasize that.
How much of a challenge was it for you to come up with this data?
Well, very challenging. There is a collection of data that counties are required to do through the state and federal health authorities called the Violent Death Reporting System data. But that data is not accessible to journalists generally. So we had to do a county by county search. And then when we looked at accidentals, there isn't one way that these types of shootings, fatal and non-fatal, are classified. So we did a layered approach where we really pulled records all different ways, using court records, using media accounts, and also using health records to try to find out how often this scenario happens. And we found over a nearly 20-year period, nearly 200 cases where there were injuries or death. And that's an at least number. We know that it's higher than that, but we try to layer an approach to say, you know, this is how often this happens in the state of Wisconsin.
Interesting in that data that the age group with the most unintentional shootings in Wisconsin appears to be 13 to 19-year-olds. Do you have a hypothesis as to why that may be, John?
Well, you know, so it's interesting that you raise that because I think a lot of times we look at the age as, you know, the 2 to 3 year olds. And that's a big that is an important category. However, what we see is that as they get older, there's different categories because there could be an accidental shooting through mishandling at that age as well. Sometimes that happens in hunting or if sometimes young people might be carrying firearms because for protection or involved with some other things. Some scenarios. And it's interesting when you get in the higher teen categories and then even into the 20s, that's quite a big category there as well.
John Dietrich, tell us a little bit about what it's like to be a reporter on the scene of an accidental shooting and what you saw, what you experienced, and what you're left with today from that reporting.
Well, it's, you know, so you have this sense for parents. And I've talked to a lot of parents in this project is that, you know, there's this sense of people have firearms for various reasons and primarily in the city of Milwaukee for protection, perhaps against an abuser in their background or for general protection because of the neighborhood that somebody lives in. And then there is the when a child is hurt or killed, there's this real punishment that comes on a parent there and then. And then the question becomes, should there be further punishment? Should the criminal justice system, you know, come in and should a parent or other caregiver be charged? And I just remember that question, you know, confronting me as a young reporter. And really that helped inform this project and launch that project some 30 years later.
Where are accidental child shootings most common in Wisconsin, John?
Well, they're happening most often in Milwaukee County. And so roughly half of the nearly 200 cases that we found occurred in Milwaukee County. So it's most common happening in the county, although it does happen in other counties as well. And again, those scenarios look different. There's hunting incidents and things of that nature. But in Milwaukee County, they're most often self-protection cases, and they are the people who are charged in these cases, and they almost always are charged in Milwaukee County, and they're almost always charged as felonies, which is a difference from the rest of the state. As we looked further into this, we found it was very clear starting in 2017 that almost every single case in Milwaukee County, like 54 were charged as felonies and 2 were charged as misdemeanors. So overwhelmingly charged as felonies. And part of the strategy with that is just what you're asking about, is the frequency of the cases. And when I talked to the prosecutor, Matthew Torbenson, who handles these cases, his point was it's happening here more often, so we need to take it more seriously and come in with some strong consequences, to include prohibition from owning a firearm, which a felony conviction brings for somebody.
So the rest of the state, largely these accidental shootings end up with misdemeanor charges or no charges at all?
Yeah, it's. I think it's important to know that there are felonies that are charged outstate, but more often, that's exactly right. They're charged as misdemeanors, and there are cases. They're happening less often. Again, it's worth reiterating that outside of Milwaukee County. And yeah, you're right. There are cases where I found no charges were filed at all. You know, a case where a police chief in a smaller city, his son got a hold of his service weapon and was shot himself and was not charged. And another family where it was treated as an accident and, a GoFundMe was established and there were not charges filed in that case.
Because of the demographics of the state and the different ways that accidental shootings are charged, do we see a racial divide in prosecution?
Yeah, there is. I mean, at the outset of that, it's always important when you're looking at criminal justice data that because of the way the African-American population's distributed in the state, more often in, more concentrated in Milwaukee County, and because of other socioeconomics, there are built-in disparities, but the disparity is noteworthy beyond what we even typically see. That the vast majority of the cases that we examined, nearly 60 cases, there was one white defendant and two Hispanic. The rest were African American, and again the relationship there was most often apparent. As we told some of these cases, some of those things became very important to how the cases played out. But yes, a racial disparity was definitely revealed in the data that we examined.
We're talking to Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative reporter John Dietrich about his analysis of first of its kind of accidental child shootings in Wisconsin. And John, you tell the story of Brianna Givens and her young son, 2-year-old Destin. Share a little bit about what happened in this accidental shooting.
Yeah, so in this case, Brianna Givens is mother of 3 children. She actually bought a gun, she and her mom, some years earlier, and she had had situations that happened where she was living with her children, where she was threatened, somebody ran up to her car and so forth, and she decided at that point to get a gun, to do the training and so forth. A situation happened later, right before the incident that brought her to our attention, where she was in a terrifying situation where a gun was put to her head and her life was threatened. And she went to police and identified the people through social media and other ways, but the case was not strong enough to charge. And so she felt very stuck. And as she told me, she at that point had to, her gun had been stolen. So she bought another gun. And in this case, she decided that she, really it was down to her to really protect her family. She was very worried that the people who had attacked her that were coming back for her. And so in her case, this is 2020 in May of 2020. And she was working as a nurse at that point. And she came home one night after a long night, this during the pandemic. And she had stopped at the emergent care and got some medication for some back pain. Anyway, that's important because she was out of her routine, as she describes it, and fell asleep. The firearm that she always kept secured was under the bed in her mattress. And the key was that her son was awake at the time. He got a hold of the firearm as she was asleep and shot himself in the hand, 2-year-old Destin did. In that case, police came immediately, and of course, the paramedics as well. And Ms. Givens was arrested and went into custody for 5 days where she didn't know anything about the condition of her son. Ultimately, she was charged with a felony. She lost her job. She's working as a nurse. She was charged with a felony child neglect. She also became homeless and was evicted. Mm-hmm. And her case, and I've spoken to Ms. Givens since then a number of times, and it's played out like this. She ultimately pled to a misdemeanor.
Okay.
But it still involved neglect. And that was important. So that means she can't work as a nurse anymore. Oh. And it's her case is just an example of how being charged with a felony can affect people's lives significantly.
And John, as you write in the journal Sentinel, these kinds of deaths should be easy to prevent, but it's not so easy in practice. Why did you find that to be?
Well, you know, as I said, the intentionality is not there. They're by definition right. unintentional shootings. And so it really comes down to the firearm and access to it. And a lot of times the messaging, though, in public health circles is around sort of just like get rid of your gun. The problem is that there's reasons why people own, firearms, and to not understand that misses how storage might be done in a way that would work both for, like in the case of Breonna Givens, that she wanted to keep the firearm close because of this threat that she was concerned about. But, you know, she thought that she would make sure that it was not available to her child. There is technology that allows for that. As I talk to gun owners, and that's really the majority of the people I've talked to in the last couple of years for this project, is that their comment was that it really is possible that these are not mutually exclusive, but it takes training and repeated training to do this, messaging, and just a sense, too, that I think parents sometimes get the sense that they are exceptional, that it won't happen to them sort of thing, or that their children are such an age, or they've had the talk with them and so forth, and it won't happen. And it's really important to understand that, as I've talked to experts and parents, too, who say that you certainly should assume the most curiosity by your child, them to do things that you would be surprised them to do. And so I think that there is a real feeling that this is something that is solvable, and it's really an education piece. Would education be the thing that would help?
Wisconsin Today spoke with Dr. Megan Scholes, a pediatric emergency physician at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And here's what she had to say about accidental child gunshot wounds.
We see a lot of gunshot wounds in Children's Wisconsin in the ER. It happens to children who have found a gun. Maybe they're at a play date and it's at a friend's home. Maybe they're at grandma's house and grandma bought a gun for protection. But a child who finds a gun sort of accidentally needs to have the education that they cannot touch it. They cannot play with it. It is very dangerous.
John, did you come across any education initiatives on gun safety in your investigation?
Yeah, there are. And I think I see something changing, too, in that sense, is that there's a sort of a stipulation that people do have firearms. They're not getting rid of them. And especially in parts of the city, I think what the doctor's speaking to and others is that there is this sense that try not to judge people who would buy firearms. Like, there's some really good reasons of people that I've talked to, and this comes from gun owners. It's really important that the number one rule is that your firearm not be accessible to somebody who's not authorized or shouldn't have it. And that would definitely be your children. And so, and if, as the doctor says, if a child comes across a firearm, it's imperative that they understand that this is not a toy and that they're not, you know, they're to go tell an adult. And I do see more of that as a public messaging campaign now.
So education, public messaging, what about new laws or legislation?
Well, I should point out Wisconsin has a child access protection law, a CAP law from 1991. Milwaukee County prosecutors are not using that law. They are essentially using a different law that was passed in 2017, a felony a charge, because this our child access protection law is a misdemeanor. There's been discussion about making it a felony. I think what our report revealed, and as I've been told, is that there is an underappreciation of the sort of results of these laws, that the charges themselves could affect people in some really dramatic ways. And I talked to researcher Matthew Miller at Harvard. He did some groundbreaking work, really, in terms of whether these laws actually change behavior. Dr. Miller and his team found that they could not find a direct correlation between storage practices and the you know, in the laws. So, and essentially it comes down to, is the fear of prosecution or is the fear of going to jail going to be greater than your desire to protect your children? And, you know, in that tension, he just found that people don't know that there is the law in their state. And if they do, that it is not likely to be changing behavior. And so, and his point was the spirit behind these laws, like Dr. Schultz is talking about and so forth, is really good because the goal is to make sure that no children have access to firearms, small children who could hurt themselves or others. His question is, hey, all the efforts that we're spending to pass laws to potentially after the fact punish parents, maybe we should put more of those resources into front end, you know, a discussion. I mean, even within an educational framework, some states have done that where they've had firearms education. It's been controversial in some places for sure, but saying, hey, let's really make this a public health campaign to stipulate that you are going to come across guns. Let's make sure that children understand not to play with them and go tell, you know, an adult. And so that I think, again, some of the discussion around the laws and what is helpful and what might be punitive and not so helpful is emerging.
John Dietrich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Lee, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
And that was Lee Rayburn talking with John Dietrich, investigative journalist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We looked at his new reporting on accidental childhood shootings in the state. It's called The Unintended Project, and it examines what happens when children are hurt or killed after they get their hands on a gun. The goal of the project is to look at how often the cases happen across Wisconsin, find out what happens afterward, and see if there are solutions to prevent these types of tragic accidents. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, take a tour of an underground labyrinth in western Wisconsin called Sandland and meet the amateur excavators who create these complex systems.
Three-dimensional tunnels are far more confusing than two-dimensional tunnels.
Got it. It is the hobby of tunneling in the Badger State. That's next from WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the last time Elvis Presley was in Wisconsin. We're sharing it today and what would have been Presley's 90th birthday.
Throughout his career, Elvis Presley mastered so many talents.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoe.
He was a musician, actor, dancer, and of course, martial artist. Elvis's passion for karate played out on the streets of Madison in the late 1970s. It was just before he played his final show in Wisconsin at the Dane County Coliseum. Writer Dean Robbins takes us back to that fateful moment in Wisconsin music history. The story first aired in August 2012 to mark the anniversary of Elvis's passing.
The Elvis Presley story has religious overtones. A poor boy is endowed with divine talent, then rises from obscurity to become a rock and roll god. I'm a true believer myself. I've even made pilgrimages to the Elvis shrines in the South, his birthplace in Tupelo, and Graceland, his home in Memphis. Many Elvis fans will flock to those sacred sites this year for the 35th anniversary of his death. But Wisconsinites needn't go that far to observe the solemn occasion. We have a sacred site of our own right in Madison, not as well known as Graceland, but authentic nonetheless. At a busy intersection on the east side of town, a small stone marker bears Elvis's image. It stands on the spot where the King of Rock and Roll performed a real miracle in the middle of the night on June 24th, 1977. Elvis had just flown into Madison for a concert, and he was still wearing his sparkly jumpsuit. On the way to a hotel, his limousine stopped at the fateful intersection, East Washington Avenue and Highway 51. Elvis looked out the window, and at the corner gas station, he saw two guys beating up a teenager. He flung open the car door. "I can't let this happen," he said in savior mode. Over the strenuous objections of his bodyguard, he strode toward the attackers. Now remember, this was the summer of 1977. Our hero was overweight and ailing. But he did have a black belt in karate and a not unwarranted confidence in his power to change the course of human affairs. One can only imagine how the villains felt when a sparkling, obese man approached them, throwing karate kicks and shouting, "I'll take you on." One can only imagine their shame when they realized it was Elvis Presley himself who had caught them in an evil act. They stopped in mid-punch, and their victim fled to safety. After such an otherworldly experience, I wouldn't be surprised if the two thugs vowed to reform right on the spot. As awed bystanders watched in wonder, Elvis shook hands all around, jumped back in his limousine, and vanished into the night.
Don't mention my name. Forget where you came.
Police officers and newspaper reporters showed up later to make sense of the visitation. The gas station rescue was the last miracle of Elvis's life. He died less than 2 months later. But Wisconsin still has the corner of East Washington Avenue and Highway 51 to remind us that he once walked among us, performing extraordinary feats. I've stood there more than once, staring at the patch of ground where the gas station used to be. I swear that, even as traffic whizzes by, you can feel Elvis's presence.
Writer Dean Robbins brought us that story on Elvis breaking up a fight in Madison. The technical producer for this piece was Joe Hartke.
If you're looking for trouble, you came to the right place.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. Wisconsin has its share of natural tunnels and caves, but in northwestern Wisconsin, a group of amateur excavators are constructing their own tunnel system through the area's plentiful sandstone. Wisconsin Today producer Trevor Hook recently ventured into the labyrinth known as Sandland. He takes us underground.
In western Wisconsin, about an hour from the Twin Cities, there's a road that splits to the north. As I get closer to my destination, I see a sign. Welcome to Sandland. Take only pictures, leave only footprints.
It's a place for people who never grew up to go crawl around and walk around and have a good time.
That's Eric Sutherland, a contract mechanical engineer who lives outside the Twin Cities. Sandland is his creation. He bought a plot of land in Wisconsin back in 2011 and began what became his passion project. Today, Eric is out here with a couple of volunteers. One is fixing a part on the tractor that workers use to haul sand from the dig site down the hill. The tractor dates back to the 1960s.
I have a shoestring budget. Managing Sandland, paying for all of our expenses to keep digging. But what we more than make up for in terms of lack of funding is savvy friends who help us out as time permits.
Sandland has more attractions than I expected. Up the hill on the right is a decommissioned monorail from the Minnesota Zoo in the Twin Cities. Volunteers made the driver's cabin into something of a miniature museum. To the left, there's a treehouse one of Eric's collaborators built a few years back, but had to bring to ground level due to safety reasons. But the main attraction, the main reason I'm here, is down the hill straight ahead. The tunnels. One of the volunteers today is Dave Gerbeth. He's one of the chief diggers at Sandland. He takes what looks like large electric chisels with blades several inches wide and carves these tunnels underground.
So I kind of plan out what I'm thinking I'm doing in there, but it's all, nobody can see it because it's all in my head. But then they'll see my results as it plays out.
This has been Eric's passion project for around 13 years. He knows digging tunnels isn't everyone's cup of tea, but he says that it plays to his strengths.
You know, I absolutely respect people who have families, kids, houses. You know, it's great. But for my entire life, being born awkward and different and having this strong interest in maps, caves, geometry, even, you know, like road maps, average annual daily traffic maps. I love that sort of thing. You know, I love being immersed in my special interests, and I don't really have much interest in family, kids, house, all that stuff.
There are a few ways to enter the tunnels. There's a door marked as an exit, and then there's what he calls the intended visitor experience. I choose the latter. We put on knee pads and headlamps. Eric turns the generator on to provide power to Dave for tunnel chiseling later in the day. Faded green paint covers a wooden door with a few signs around it. The intended entrance to Sandland is small. It's only about 3 feet tall. The only way through is to crawl. The only light is from our headlamps. This tunnel system is made of Jordan sandstone, native to Wisconsin and states like Minnesota and Illinois throughout the upper Midwest. In the tunnels, it looks like horizontal layers of white, orange, and gray stone that speckles a bit under direct light. You may wonder about the safety of going through the tunnels at Sandland. It's certainly something I considered while on my hands and knees crawling through a hole into the side of a bluff.
I feel pretty confident that the risk of exploring our tunnels is very low compared to a lot of, you know, common activities like riding a bicycle. And I think for people who are mobile and outdoorsy, I think the reward is very, very much worth the risk.
After crawling for around 70 feet, I reached a fork in the road. One tunnel going left, one right. Because the entrance to Sandland isn't just a crawling tunnel, it's a crawling maze.
I deliberately designed the maze so that you can't see any other intersection from any given intersection, because that makes it more confusing and mysterious.
Okay, all right, I'll go right.
All right. Congratulations, you've taken the path less traveled because it's steeper. A lot of people go the easy way.
He's right. It's not the easy way. The sandstone is hard, even with knee pads and gloves. I'm carrying my microphone and audio recorder while we crawl, so I'm a bit slower than I'd like to be. After a few minutes, we're at another fork. I choose left, unsure if I'm about to enter one of the many loops Eric has made in this maze.
Pretty much every maze loop, I think there's three of them total, you go underneath yourself to be able to do a figure eight. Because three-dimensional tunnels are far more confusing than two-dimensional tunnels.
Yeah.
And so that's why we have all the ups and downs, just to make it confusing.
Right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, left. I'm crawling through section after section, and I'm getting hot. The temperature in the tunnel system is in the upper 40s, much warmer than above ground. I'm starting to sweat. The tunnel I'm in now is starting to look a little bit familiar. Or is it? Okay. Without spoiling, have I done a circle?
Would your visitor experience be better if I told you? Would you prefer to know, or would you prefer to have the mystery? I don't think it'll help you significant.
Sure, then let me know.
You did go in a loop.
I did, okay.
After a few more minutes, I let Eric coach me through the maze, because I know there's more to see. Carving new tunnels in Sandland is a time-intensive process. The crawling maze alone took 5 years to complete. Down the ramp, we take a corner and emerge in a large circular area that Eric dubs the donut room.
It is a septagon. It's got basically one tunnel that's 5 feet wide, so it basically duplexes as a room where you can hang out and store things. And it's got seven different segments, each of which are about 11 feet long. We deliberately made it a septagon as opposed to an octagon because people would come in here expecting an octagon. And so if they're counting the drifts that come off of it, drift is a word for a side tunnel in mining speak, but if they're counting the drifts, they'd get a little confused.
The donut room is essentially a hub area that connects the rest of Sandland together. Each side tunnel here curves too, leaving you with no idea what's around the corner. Some are deliberate dead ends, others lead to attractions that are under construction, like a 40-foot-long underground slide and a standing-level labyrinth called the Globe Maze. But the star of the show, the end goal of Sandland, was created by a contributor named Gabe. And it's one of the most Wisconsin things I've ever heard of.
This is Gabe's bar. Everything was designed and dug and created by Gabe. Gabe identified, you know, Dave and I are creating a lot of places you can move through, but we aren't really creating anywhere as like a place to hang out and move to.
The bar is a bit snug at around 15 feet long, with nearly everything carved directly out of sandstone. The bar on the left, the two booths and accompanying tables on the right are all solid sandstone. The sand grains throughout the tunnels here are bigger, more coarse than the sand you'd run into on a beach. Around the corner from the bar, before we head back outside, Eric and I hear a sound from a nearby tunnel. It's what Eric dubs the sound of progress. Eric's friend Dave is digging another section of tunnel, and it's time for Eric to take out a wagon full of sand.
How many wagons do you think I'll get in one day?
It all, you know, like my statistics professor at UW-Madison said, it all depends. You know, that's a really easy, quick place to get sand from. Most of the places, like back in the Globe Maze, if it's just Dave and I, we'd be lucky to get 15 in a good day.
After a short trek, Eric and I emerge from the lowest entrance to the tunnels. As he dumps the sand onto a fenced-in pile on the side of the ravine, I realize the sun's about to set. I've been in the caves for at least 3 hours. Time in Sandland is measured in years. Eric and his colleagues make plans for what they want to sculpt underground 5, 10, and even 20 years in advance. But Dave, the person who digs the most at Sandland, is 72 years old. Both Dave and Eric say they know that Dave might only have a few years of digging left in him at the complex. Eric himself is 44 years old and has early signs of kneecap arthritis from his years of cave exploration. But Eric is thinking much larger than the two of them for the future of Sandland.
I'm the sole member of our LLC, and in the long run, once I pass, it'll be a group of our top contributors because they are the people that can be most trusted to stay true to our mission and not try to, for example, divert it for profit.
Keeping true to that mission is important for Eric and his colleagues, because despite this tour, despite how generous Eric was with his time for me, Sandland isn't open to the general public. But, in Eric's words, they do welcome visitors and donations, and they hope to well into the future.
If Sandland was only going to last 30 years, we wouldn't be digging at all, because, you know, that wouldn't be much benefit for our efforts. But since it's likely to last 1,000 years, and hopefully thousands, if not tens of thousands, if not more, people will get to crawl through and have this unique experience that they'll remember for the rest of their lives. You know, that's a huge, huge motivation to keep on digging and make it as exciting as we can.
For Wisconsin Today, I'm Trevor Hook.
And thanks to Tyler Ditter for technical direction on that piece. You can listen back to that trip underground and all of the conversations we've had here on the show at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. Join us tomorrow morning for live special coverage of former President Jimmy Carter's state funeral service from the Washington National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Host Stephen Skeep and NPR's political team will bring you the entire service from the National Cathedral and offer analysis. President Joe Biden declared tomorrow a national day of mourning. Again, we'll be bringing you live special coverage of Carter's official state funeral here on WPR News and at WPR.org starting at 8:30 in the morning. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.